I think what one needs to improve is the quality of decisions and not necessarily the quality of outcomes, because the quality of outcomes are not necessarily in our hands, right? Sometimes you can make a really good decision and, you know, luck might not be on your side and it could be disastrous.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of How to Product, a podcast series brought to you by PM School. And I'm your host, Arjav Jain. So far in this season, we've had some tremendous guests like Kanav from Urban Company, Amit Phule from Microsoft, and Jackie Bavaro. And we've had some great discussions on product management. How does engineering look at it? How has the role evolved? How to continue to grow in this role, and a lot more. So if you haven't checked out our previous episodes, make sure to do that after you listen to what we have in store for you in this one. I personally had such a fun time recording this episode with one of the most prominent names in the Indian product ecosystem. So let's begin. Anshumani has spent the last 17 years crafting experiences and products for users, first as an author of children's books and then as a game designer on some of the world's largest social games, Mafia Wars, Cafe World, to name a few. And then as a product manager across various consumer tech businesses across gaming, messaging, healthcare, education, and the media industry in India. He was the VP of product at Practo and then the chief product officer at QMath, an edtech company. He then went on to lead the sports, social, and gaming charter as the VP of product at Hotstar. And he's currently the app PM lead for Google Pay as a group product manager at Google. Welcome to the show and thank you so much for joining us, Anshumani.
Thanks, Arjav. Good to be here.
Awesome. So I have a lot of questions for you, so I'm going to dive right in, right? Very interestingly, you started off as writing storybooks for kids, and you've been an author, right? And storytelling is an art that product managers should definitely add to their arsenal, right? So could you help break down the structure of a good story for our listeners?
So, there's this famous Stephen King book in which he actually sort of goes quite in depth into talking about what does one need to do to be a good writer. There's some really good advice that he gives there. He talks about what do you do if you're writing a murder mystery, right? And he says that when you're writing a murder mystery, you don't start with how the murder has happened. Mm-hmm. At the beginning, your hook has to be incredibly strong. So the murder should have already happened. When you're starting a whodunit, you're starting with, damn, the murder has happened and who did it, right? So from the get-go, you're gripping your users, you're gripping your readers, right, in a story. And he gives examples of classic sort of stories where, murder mysteries and, very intense edge of the seat sort of storytelling.
Yeah.
And the point is that you don't waste your time in sort of, creating this massive preamble as to what happened. You get to the meat of things.
Okay.
So the hook is very strong. Now, if you think about it, this advice applies to building good products as well.
Yeah.
Get users to the moment of joy. Get users to the happy place as soon as possible. Right?
Yeah.
And if you think about that, that in writing and in product management, if these things are important, then you realize how critical writing itself is to being a PM. Now, this is one side, which is that writing structure, which is, the classic beginning, middle, and end structure of a well-written story, but mm-hmm. also creating these really strong hooks, is a very, very strong parallel to building good products.
Right.
But then there's a second part, which is the act of writing itself. And the act of writing itself is about crystallizing your thoughts and making mm-hmm. sure that you bring it to a place where what's in your mind is very clear to what people are reading.
Right.
So there is nothing getting lost in translation. And I think this is a genuine superpower, because a big part of what PMs do is set the vision for the entire org, set the vision for the entire product. But they're also trying to tell people, why are we doing what we are doing? And why would users care if we did this?
Right.
right? And that pretty much goes into sort of the root of everything that everyone around them, the engineers, the designers, you know, folks in sales and marketing, everyone else is doing this because of a reason, because of answering these two whys. Why should we as a company solve this problem, and why would users care? And I think, which is why writing is such an important superpower for PMs. Product managers who can write well and who can condense incredibly difficult topics and incredibly difficult decision-making criteria into well-structured, well-written documents, essentially then turn these into artifacts which can be relied on year after year. And what that means is it maintains a level of continuity in the organization. So the ideal case scenario is if you're at a startup or a mid-stage company, that this company survives for many, many years and grows and thrives. And if that happens, what happens is there's a lot of this cult, what I call tribal knowledge, right? The folks who originally built the company are not necessarily there when, you know, a big chunk of time has passed. It is only documents that you look at, old documents written by the first set of PMs and the first set of engineers, that you get a sense of, oh, this is why we made these decisions. This is why, you know, we have to pay debt now. This is why... this is why this part of the product behaves the way like this. And which is why I think writing again becomes really important. So I think sort of three aspects there, right? One is writing is very similar to building good products. Two, the act of clarifying your thoughts for everyone else means that everyone else is on the same page. And three, it acts as a historical and cultural reminder and sort of a historical artifact of the decisions that were made and why they were made in the way they were made.
Right. So this reminds me of Amazon's, you know, famous or infamous, whatever you, however people want to look at it, the PR FAQ document that they have, right? Which is everything that you want to build needs to start off with, hey, look forward and, you know, see what that press release is going to look like, and then write all the FAQs that could come out of it.
Absolutely. Right? And it's such an amazing culture because Amazon is very famous for both a writing and a reading culture. So, you know, they expect people to send out pre-reads. But even if, you know, at the beginning of a meeting, if everyone has not gone through the material, they actually block out the first 15 minutes so everyone can go through the documentation that was sent in advance.
Right.
And then you spend the remainder of the 45 minutes actually just discussing the open questions.
Right.
We do this well at Google as well, where Google's a very reading and writing intensive culture.
Okay.
Everything is captured in documents. People are expected to read through documents, ask questions, get their questions answered. The writers of the documents are encouraged to answer as many questions as possible. Mm-hmm. And then meetings are a lot more effective. And one could argue that, hey, you know, this seems like Amazon and Google, well-established companies, you know, this doesn't work at early stage or mid stage. But I would actually argue that this is, in fact, even more required at early stage and mid stage companies, because at the end, you are only as good as the decisions you make. And those decisions are going to be made basis these documents. So, you know, that the classic, the Amazon example that you gave of writing the press release even before the product is built is such a strong way of pretty much doing a pre-mortem.
Right.
You're essentially saying, hey, we release this today and it becomes a success. What does that success look like? What does that press release look like when we put out this feature? And then what are the questions that people would ask us?
Correct.
Right. And that essentially tells you how easy or difficult it is for users to even understand what you're building. And then imagine the thought that then goes into actually building that product. If I read your press release and I don't understand what you've built and I'm not excited about it, then there's no reason for somebody to fund that product.
That's true.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah. Switching, I think it's a great way of building products.
For sure. Yeah. That's something that I think we should also start adopting, like you said, at smaller companies, right? I've been talking to a few PMs in smaller companies, and this isn't a culture that exists, but there is the need for it for sure. Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you did touch upon this. And my next question is basically, how and why should product managers become better storytellers? You did touch upon it in some points in your previous answer, but if you could sort of focus on how and why should product managers become better storytellers?
So I think the how of writing, good writing, actually begins with reading.
Mm-hmm.
So product managers need to be reading machines. They need to read a lot. They need to read everything. And I know, you know, folks won't have time for fiction, but they should read as much nonfiction as possible.
Mm-hmm.
More importantly, if you are in larger companies and you have the advantage of other product managers, senior PMs around you, and when I say senior, I mean more in terms of experience.
Right.
Read their documents. See why they are so good at the documents that they write. And I think that's how you become. The more you read, the more you get a sense of what good writing is about. But then writing, like every other skill, is all about practice.
Right.
You can't talk about writing.
Mm-hmm.
You don't become a writer just by reading other people or just by talking about the fact that you're going to write. You become better at writing by writing, right? In the world of fiction, the fairly standard truth is that your first million words are complete trash. It's very rare for somebody to write a decent story with their first million words. Now, just to give you a sense, a typical 250 page book is about 80,000 words.
Words.
What I'm essentially saying is your first 10 novels are essentially not the worthiest writing that you do.
Wow.
Right? And that's it's a craft. It's not an art.
Mm-hmm.
It's a craft. You know, you have to have that craftsman's approach to writing as well.
Right.
Just like, you know, if you were a sculptor, you would make thousands of sculptures. If you were a painter, you would paint and paint and paint and become much better over time. Writing is very similar. Right? Now, the PMs out there who are listening to this are saying, hey, we have to run a product also and build a product also.
Exactly.
You are asking us to put in our, you know, the proverbial 10,000 hours into becoming a better writer.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is that it has to start somewhere. You have to keep practicing and sort of write detailed emails, write detailed documents, and actually get a sense of when people have read your documents, did they actually understand what you were trying to convey?
Mm.
Did people understand in your product requirement document, were your requirements clear? When you wrote those critical user journeys or jobs to be done framework, whichever framework you use, did people actually understand it?
Mm-hmm.
Do your designers get what you're trying to tell them? Do your engineers get what you're trying to tell them? And that sort of helps you understand that no, you have to sort of go back to the drawing board and write better. It's a very, very strong feedback loop, actually.
Yeah.
To be truly honest, a bad document results in a bad product.
I'm sure.
So,
yeah.
So essentially then you go back to the drawing board and start writing better documents, because if it is not clear to everyone who reads your document what has to be built and why it has to be built and how it has to be built, then you're starting out a chain reaction of disasters. So it very quickly forces you to genuinely think about how you're going to become a better writer. And I think the short answer to that is it just requires practice. Like everything else, this is a skill. It's a skill that can be acquired.
Mm-hmm.
It requires hard work to acquire it. So read good writing, but write a lot. The other way of getting really good at it is by putting your writing out there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, write blogs, write long LinkedIn posts, if that makes sense to you.
Right.
Write Twitter. But essentially put content out there, put written content out there. You'd get instant feedback. You'd know if you're getting your message across to people.
Makes sense. That's great advice. And you touched upon reading great nonfiction as well. So any suggestions, anything that you found as great material to read as just suggestions for our listeners?
I sort of keep a fairly low filter on what I read. So my filter is that I first check if the book is available on Blinkist. I have a Blinkist subscription.
Okay.
And then I turn on the Blinkist audio at 2x, and quickly go through the blinks and sort of figure out what this book is all about.
Mm-hmm.
If by the middle of when Blinkist essentially turns an entire book into a 10-12 minute summary of what the book is about. And if you're listening at 2x, you essentially get the whole thing in 6 minutes, but halfway through is 3 minutes. And those 3 minutes are good enough for you to figure out, oh, okay, this book seems to have some decent insights. Time to actually purchase it and read it. So my first filter is through Blinkist.
Okay.
And then I quickly add those books on my Kindle. If I feel like this is a book worth reading, I add it to Kindle and or Audible. Depends. I've been reading to a lot more audiobooks also of late, but usually I read pretty fast, so it's always a bit of a tussle between listening and reading. I think I absorb more when I read as opposed to listen.
Yeah.
So I prefer reading. But the reason I started doing the Blinkist filter is that my own personal filters are fairly low. I'm one of those people who doesn't walk out of a movie theater even if the movie is bad. I subject myself to 3 hours of agony. Right. Same is true for books also. Okay. I realized that there were a lot of books I would start and then I would sort of almost, you know, pressure myself into going through them.
Mm-hmm.
And a longish book is, you know, you're reading a 200, 300 page book. Even if you read 50, 60 pages an hour, you're still spending 6 hours of your life reading.
Yeah, this. That's true.
So the Blinkist check essentially takes that pressure off me. Because I only purchase the book after I've gone through Blinkist and made up my mind that, yes, this book is worth reading. The only other time that I don't go through Blinkist is if the book comes very highly recommended from someone whose reading skills I trust.
That's right? Awesome. That's someone a great way to filter though. Yeah.
Yes. You know, there are, I have a group of people who I know are prodigious readers.
Mm-hmm.
They read everything. And when they say that, hey, this book is life-changing, please read it. I never, then that doesn't go through the Blinkist filter. That just directly goes into my reading.
Awesome.
And the second way to sort of make sure that you read a lot is, carve out time. Mm-hmm. Carve out time every single day. I consider a day not complete if I haven't read anything that day.
Okay.
So even if it means sort of staying up from 11 p.m. to 11:45 p.m. every night and reading before I sleep, I make sure that I do that. So read every day and try and get through a book a week at least. I think all PMs should read at least 50 books a year, if not more.
Wow. Any suggestion for a book that you have that we can get started off on?
The book that I always recommend is, it's not a new book, came out 3-4 years back, 2018, I think, is Annie Duke's Thinking in Bits.
I think
in terms of a book around decision making and why your quality of decision making has to be great. Thinking in Bets is unparalleled. I think it's a must read for all product managers. But in general, it's good life advice for everyone because we are decision making machines if you think about it.
Yeah.
So being better decision makers, especially as PMs, being better decision makers is sort of the do or die quality for us. So yeah, this and then I think she has a follow up book called How to Decide, which is also fantastic. But yeah, Thinking in Bets first and then How to Decide.
Awesome. So you spoke about decisions and I'm sure through the years, you've made a lot of decisions in your career or we'll stick to career. And and I'm sure there have been mistakes on the way, right?
Of course.
So I'm sure. And that's, I mean, you learn from those, right? So is there a specific mistake that you think that you've made that our listeners can basically learn from and avoid early in their careers?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think what one needs to improve is the quality of decisions and not necessarily the quality of outcomes, because the quality of outcomes are not necessarily in our hands, right?
Right.
Sometimes you can make a really good decision and, you know, luck might not be on your side and it could be disastrous, especially with career decisions, right? So what happens is sometimes we make a poor decision, but things just turn out okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you land up at a company, you didn't really think too much about it. You didn't do, any reference checks. You sort of didn't really think very deeply about who you're going to be working with or what you're going to be working on. But things just turned out okay. You know, it turned out to be a rocket ship. So you were at the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
And the company grew massively. And because of that, you got the benefit of being at that place and sort of building the right things. but your decision making was still bad. You probably shouldn't have joined this company.
Yeah.
Right? Or it, you know, you actually had a very tortured 2-3 years. Mm-hmm. So resulting can always make you sort of question your decisions itself. So I think one of the things which I always want people is that, you know, like, your decision making could be good, outcome could be bad. Your decision making could be bad and the outcome could be good. But long term, just keep focusing on your decision making. Now, in terms of my own career, I think the mistake that I made very early on in my career was not asking for more.
Okay.
And when I say not asking, essentially forget more, I think not asking.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what happens is that when you're smart and you're sort of fairly confident in your skills, you assume that everyone around you can also see how good you are at what you do. And you expect that, hey, you know, things are meritocratic.
Yeah.
That other people should be lining up to give you opportunities because, you know, you're God's gift to
yeah. mankind. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. It's classic hubris. It's a classic young man's sort of pride.
Yeah.
But I was given this advice, and I always say that this was probably the best advice I could get very early on in my career. Where one of the PMs I worked with very closely, she pulled me aside and said, "Anshu, a few of us know you're very good, mm-hmm. and we would always pull you in, and we'll always sort of make sure that we involve you in a project and give you more opportunities."
Right.
But you do realize everyone else doesn't know that, and actually mm-hmm. everyone doesn't need to know that and doesn't care. So one of the things that you need to be able to do well is not just do the work, but once you have done the work, also ask for more, ask for opportunities.
Right.
So if it means that if you think you should have been promoted, you should actually have that conversation with your manager and say that, hey, I think I've had a really successful 6 months or 1 year.
Yeah.
I think I should be given more responsibility and I should be moved to the next year. Similarly, if there is a big project that's coming up and you think you would be the right person to work on it, or you would like to champion it, until unless you raise your hand, you're not going to get the project. Don't just assume that people are lining up to give you projects. Yeah. And that hit me really hard. That feedback hit me incredibly hard. And I've since then never shied away from raising my hand, from asking for more, because what's the worst that can happen? Somebody says no. And that's okay. That's completely yeah. fine. Somebody tells you, no, you're not ready for prime time. I think you need another 6 months before you can take on this next project. Or that, no, I think somebody else might do a better job than you right now, and because we think you don't have that skill. Right there, you got really good feedback. Somebody told you that they don't think you are as good as you think you are, or that you don't have a skill set that you always thought you had.
Right.
And you might not have even known that you needed that skill set for a particular job. And that's your road to becoming better at what you do. Now, the inverse of this is also true.
Mm-hmm.
The inverse of this is you ask for everything, right? And you ask for more.
Yeah.
But what that means is you fall into this trap. You could become overzealous and you could fall for this trap that you are overcommitting and under-delivering.
Yeah.
And this is something that a lot of good PMs fall into this trap. I've seen a lot of good PMs, good designers, good engineers, they all fall into this trap, right? We back ourselves, right?
Yeah.
We back ourselves that, hey, we'll be able to do this. Engineers do this through giving bad estimates.
Yeah.
All the time. Good engineers give bad estimates all the time. And good PMs also overestimate their own skills and say, yeah, I'll be able to do A, B, and C simultaneously.
Yeah.
And this is something you only learn with sort of maturity as a PM. As you sort of get into your third or fourth year, and hopefully you can, I hope every PM out there learns this faster.
Yeah.
So while the first point is really relevant, that you have to ask for things, you really have to ask for, more opportunities.
Yeah.
You also have to be very careful that you don't spread yourself too thin.
Makes sense. The extension of that thought in my head is similar to how we used to look at, you know, velocity of a team, like when they're delivering in a sprint,
mm-hmm.
right? Absolutely. And then you eventually get to a point where you're mature enough to understand what your velocity is and how much you can deliver in a sprint, right?
That word right there, right, is such a beautiful word, velocity.
Yeah.
It implies two things. It implies speed and direction.
Yep.
So what usually happens with people who are forces of nature, and we've all seen these. We've seen great designers, engineers, PMs around us who are like, you know, just like they can move mountains, but sometimes they move the mountain in the wrong direction. Yep. So speed, you know, they prefer speed over everything else, and you have to keep reminding them that yes, speed is important, but so is direction.
Yeah.
So even if your velocity sometimes is slow, is slower, you're still moving in the right direction, and that's a that has a much bigger impact than moving fast and moving in the wrong direction, or not moving at all sometimes, just being in the same place. And I think that's something else that PMs need to be very, very careful about.
Great advice. So over the years, you've been a part of building some great products, right? At Hotstar, at QMath, at Practo, and now at Google. And I'm sure you've sort of built some mental models to figure out, you know, what's the quality of a product, right? And I want to peep into that and see, so what are the criteria that you use for judging how successful a product is?
So there's this wonderful hierarchy of user needs diagram, right? Which starts at the bottom is just pure functionality. It works.
Yeah.
Right. So the first criteria of whether a product is good or not is the fact that it works. It was built for doing a particular job. You know, you were supposed to order food, or a video was supposed to start playing when you click the button. So is it functional? Step two is it reliable? Which means if I press that video start button again and again on multiple videos, does it happen each time? So does it work as expected every single time? So it's functional, it's reliable. The third bit is where things become interesting. Is it usable? Is it easy to find that video? Is it easy to figure out that where the play button is, and whether that triangular looking thing is actually the play button? And now that I can play it, can I pause it? Can I easily move from a portrait mode to a landscape mode?
Right.
And this is usability. This is where user experience and usability and design sort of comes into place. So three layers, right? Functional, reliable, and usable. But a lot of good PMs and good designers actually stop here. There's a fourth layer, which is the layer of delight or pleasurability. Is the overall experience, now that you've built this cake, is there icing on the cake?
Right.
Does it come in a good box? Is it marketed well? Is the overall experience just genuinely sort of brings joy to your users?
Yeah.
And the problem is this fourth layer is not measurable with ease.
Yeah.
Right. The other three are fairly metrics driven.
Right.
But delight and pleasurability is not. Pleasurability happens when you go for a tatkal booking for your passport and actually walk out an hour later.
Yeah.
And get that passport end of that day. That's And that the reason I'm giving that example is that that happened this time around.
Yeah.
For me, I was getting my passport renewed, and that, so it was functional, reliable, usable, and oh my God, was it pleasurable? I was overjoyed that in India I could get my passport renewed, like literally, fast-moving line, got it all done in 1 hour, and then in the evening the passport was delivered, and I got the police check also done. I could actually travel the next week.
Wow.
So that that experience, right? And that's experience. That's the zenith of good user experience. So this is how I judge products also. So when I'm building products, or when I'm looking at other products, I'm always looking for this, right? And I always see, like, you know, there are products which are very functional and reliable, which is also rare, by the way. Reliability means your technology is really good. Reliability means that there are lots of checks and balances in place.
Right.
But then as you move into the usability layer, usability, by the way, is the big moat. Between two products and two teams, which are essentially building the exact same product, eventually the product which is more usable will win. But between two products which are equally usable, the product which has delight built into it will win out the market, right? And that takes time, it takes effort. By the way, there are people who try and add delight even before they've added functionality. We see this a lot. I was having this mini argument with someone who pointed out a bunch of products saying, these are such good looking products. And I'm like, well, you said it. They are good looking products.
Yeah.
They are, you know, aesthetically pleasing.
Yeah.
not functional or usable. So trying to add delight even before you've added any of the third layers is literally serving icing alone and no cake.
Yeah.
I see that a lot, by the way, happening, I think, because that's when sort of design and product actually doesn't get what users genuinely care for.
Yeah. And it goes back to the concept of PRFAQ. Like, if you're able to write down.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Your user wanted to do something simple.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, this is at Hotstar, for example, when an IPL or a World Cup is going on and the final is going on, you're breaking concurrency records. You know, there are 10 million users, then there are 15 million users in that 1 minute, then there are 20 million, and then we have 25 million. Now, what do you do at this point where your CDNs are overloaded, where India's entire data pipeline is essentially being consumed by video?
Yeah.
Right. How do you ensure that a new user who comes in, the 25,999,999th user who comes in, that user is able to press the play button and actually watch the match?
Yep.
At that point, you don't care whether other things work or not. Maybe the scorecard is not visible to this user.
Right.
Maybe search within the, and I'm not saying that we would sort of remove this, but we would actually move to a lighter variant of the product.
Makes sense.
Make fewer calls. Just ensure that the video plays, because all this guy wants to see at that point is that final ball being bowled between MI and CSK.
Right.
And you know, if that final has gone to the super over, if your user misses the super over because your app didn't open or your video didn't click, imagine the number of brickbats you would get on Twitter,
right,
and on social media, right?
Yeah,
I think that actually is the highlight for me of good engineering, good product principles, good design principles, right? That it works. It works when it is at a level that has not been seen before anywhere in the world.
Right. Makes sense. So you filter down as to what is the user really trying to accomplish. And the example that you quoted is extreme, where, you know, you've got 25 million concurrent users.
Correct.
But even in that scenario.
Absolutely. Even if this was the very first user watching that match.
Correct.
What is the intent? The user has just come with the intent of watching the match.
Yeah.
Give him the cake first. Icing can come later.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Awesome. So just to summarize that, make sure that the product is functional, it's reliable, which is it works as expected, it's usable, and then focus on delight and pleasure. And that would be your sort of criteria to judge how a successful product is.
Yes.
Yeah. Awesome. So over the years, I'm sure you've hired a lot of PMs on your team as well, right? And I wanted to get a sense of what do you look for a PM hire on your team?
So depending on depending on which area and with how much experience you want to hire people, this answer changes a lot.
Right.
If I'm sure that this team is well structured and has experienced people who could give direction to the person who's coming in. So I expect all PMs to be independent.
Yeah.
But I do expect that some PMs will need some level of handholding and direction, but then work independently.
Yeah.
But then there are roles where you want the PM to come in and not just be independent, but set their own direction. They come up with a plan for themselves.
Right.
And that's essentially an experienced PM. That's essentially someone who's been there and done that. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think these two criteria. So essentially what your level of independence is. So you first in your, you know, this is an internal job description diagram, right? Like if you're writing an internal job description document for, hey, so I have to hire a PM in my team. Mm-hmm. You look at the structure of your team and you first figure out what is going to be the level of independence of a PM who's coming in. Second, you look at what is their area of influence. Is this a PM whose area of influence is only his or her pod? Which means that they will work with a few engineers, they'll work with one designer, they'll be feature PMs, they'll work on a specific part of the product. Or their area of influence will be much higher. In fact, they might impact the entire product or entire product line, right? Like they are a growth PM. They will affect the growth of your product, which is in its growth phase. Or that this PM is responsible for all of retention and engagement, or this PM is responsible for monetization.
Right.
So what is their area of influence? And then it could be like, hey, you're hiring a senior director or a VP of product, right? You're hiring someone who's going to come and pretty much be the face of your product org.
Right.
So you look at level of independence, you look at area of influence, and then you look at a third sort of a criteria list, which is, do you need this person to be very execution focused? Do you need this person to be both execution and tactics focused? Or do you need this person to be all three, which is execution, tactics, and strategy?
Right.
And this is sort of linked to the very first thing that we spoke about, which is, you know, their level of independence.
Yeah.
Can they define direction for themselves? Because defining direction also means that you have to have a strategic frame of mind.
Yeah.
You can also come up with tactics, which road to pick. But I think all PMs need to do all three things, which is execution, tactics, and strategy. But, you know, at different stages of your PMing life, you do these three things
Correct.
In very different portions.
Correct.
So the first thing I always look at is these three frameworks and figure out sort of like while I'm creating the job description document, these are the three things I look at. You know, where does this PM fit in terms of area of influence, in terms of level of independence, and then, you know, how much strategic thinking do they need and how tactical do they need to be?
Right.
So these three things together is what gives you a sense of who should you be interviewing. So how should you shortlist? And then what are the kind of questions you would ask them?
Yeah. Great. Yeah. So if I had to narrow it down to, let's say, if you were going to hire, let's say, an early in career PM on your team, right? In that case, you it's probably going to be, let's say, execution and tactics more than strategy.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. Because I'm hiring a relatively less experienced PM.
Correct.
So I'm sure then that strategically the company is sound. We have strategic direction, right? And other people have to come and figure out how to do it and what to do. So tactics and execution. And yeah, exactly. So that lens is then very clear.
Awesome. So Anshumani, this has been awesome. There's been a lot of great advice in our conversation so far. But if there's anything that you want to leave our audience with, and our listeners mainly are folks who are trying to break into this role, and if there's any advice for them.
I think my advice to people who are trying to become product managers or who are trying to break into product management always is use a lot of products, right? Use a lot of products and always be deconstructing. Now, deconstructing is essentially, it's a few things. What about this product works and why?
Right.
What about this product does not work and why not?
Right.
But this is not where we stop. You have to go one step further and be able to answer, if I was the product manager on this product, this is how I would fix it and this is how I would make it better.
Right.
And then there is a last layer. How would I build something 10x better? How would I compete against this product? So what works and why? What doesn't work and why not? And how would I fix it and make it better? And then how would I make it 10x better and actually compete against it?
Right.
I think this mental sort of breakdown and deconstruction of a product is common sense.
Yeah.
Right? It's common sense in the sense that you could come from a commerce background or an engineering background or a sales or a marketing background.
Yeah.
You might never have worked with an engineer,
but
as long as you use a product, you can pretty much try and answer all these questions and get in depth into answering these questions. And if you can do that, then you're slowly developing a product manager's mindset.
Right.
You're thinking like a PM. And I think that's a prerequisite to becoming a PM. You have to start thinking like one. And then you slowly sort of enter that journey of becoming one.
Yeah. So you don't need the title of a product manager to be a product manager.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, see, product managers become product managers by product managing.
Right.
It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy, right?
Yeah.
It's suddenly somebody one day decided to give you that title. You didn't go to school for that.
That's true.
I mean, engineers learned coding, right? Either they went to school for it or they picked up coding, right?
Yeah.
And there's a sort of a clear curricula to follow.
Correct.
Designers learned how to design. What did PMs learn? And of course, people are trying to sort of change that. And, you know, we are trying to teach folks how to become PMs. But the reality is one day you just get into that role and then you're trying to get over the imposter syndrome and sort of looking at yourself in the mirror and constantly telling yourself, I'm a PM. Like this mantra that you're telling you. It's the first is the act of convincing yourself that you're a PM.
Right.
And hoping that that nobody else catches you and says that, is he really a PM? Is she really a PM? So it's self-belief, and then that belief transcends and sort of other people start believing it, and you know, you get the title and you actually start doing the work, and then suddenly you realize, wow, I can do this. I am a PM. So it's that. It's always been that. This is one of those roles where I think more than engineers, more than designers, PMs suffer from massive imposter syndrome.
Oh yeah, right? For sure.
And you only become a PM after you've become a PM. So it's one of those crazy things.
Awesome. Anshumani, this has been nothing short of great. Thank you so much for taking your time out and speaking with us. Right. And
pleasure,
thank you. Thank
My
you.
Pleasure. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Anshumani is an endless source of great knowledge and experience. I hadn't personally realized that we had been chatting for over 40 minutes, and that speaks for itself. You can also check out his YouTube channel where he puts out new content regularly if you liked what you heard. You can experience what a PM does by stepping into the shoes of a product manager with PM School's live program. Check out pmschool.io and apply now. We're available on all major podcast streaming apps, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts. Make sure you've subscribed to us to be notified about every new episode. We'll be back with another one very soon. Until then, stay curious and stay safe. This is your host, Arjav Jain, signing off.